Listening test. Task 1. You're going to listen to a recording about recycling plastic bottles. First, you'll have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C or D, for questions 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
What most people don't realise is the polymer that's used to make plastic bottles is exactly the same polymer that's used to make fabrics, polyethylene terephthalate. So old Coke bottles, if you like, can be reformed into useful fabrics.
And how do you go from the kind of rigidity of a Coke bottle, a plastic one, to what we've got here, which is, you know, the blazer you're showing me feels like just like any other form of cloth, soft, not kind of particularly shiny, all the rest of it?
Yeah, what happens is that the bottles that we all put in our bottle banks, most of those end up back in Asia and are resorted into clear plastic bottles. They are chipped and then broken down into the basic polymer ingredients and then repolymerized back into the polymer and then spun out into make a fibre.
And these are the first in the country, first school uniform entirely made of Coke bottles right down to the buttons?
Yeah, this is the first blazer ever to be made where all the ingredients, the fusibles inside the buttons, the zips, the pocket bags, the lining is all made from recycled polyester.
What's been the reaction from schools to this?
They're very, very interested because schools all have sustainability targets and the headmasters and mistresses are all very keen to meet these targets and this would help them achieve those goals.
I gather you were at a conference, weren't you, the other day where this came up?
Yeah, we did a conference in Birmingham, the Specialist Schools and Academies Trust Show, and a lot of interest from head teachers at that conference.
The blazer, you know, when I was a teenager, it was kind of just about on its way out, and then the 60s seemed to kill it altogether, but that's not the case, I gather.
Yeah, what happened is in the late 60s, early 70s, a product that was developed actually for Americans to go jogging in, the sweatshirt, made its way into the uniform market. That's making its way out of the uniform market now, actually, as we go along, because it tends to fade and pill a lot and lose its shape, and it's a leisure wear look. A lot of schools have realised that a more formal look will help with their discipline. So, in particular, inner-city schools that are trying to improve the discipline and education are putting the children back into blazers and ties.
Are they more pricey, these Coca-Cola blazers?
No, we're selling them about £1 more than a conventional blazer. So they'll start at about £25 and go up to about £27 for the larger sizes.
Charlotte Denning here, who works for School Colours, has just been kindly modelling the blazer. What's it like to wear? I mean, is it like any other blazer?
It's very lightweight. Very lightweight indeed. It's kind of, and also it's very soft, so you don't, it's very comfortable to wear. So you don't really, it's not something that, I mean, especially as kind of a school, like you used to wear school uniform. I think kids would find it not uncomfortable, especially if they're wearing it all day and having to wear it, you know, from morning till afternoon.
And would you think, I mean, I've got two, well, they're grown up now, but two sons, when they were boys, they were very hot on all this kind of environmental stuff, you know, and recycling. Is that, do you think that'll have an appeal to school-aged children today?
I think it will. I think it's getting kind of more appealing to kind of the younger generation. Maybe it didn't used to be, but I think it is getting better and better. And I think younger people are realising that and how to recycle, and they're getting taught how to recycle as well. So,
I mean, they might even... Could it be cool to wear a Coca-Cola blazer?
I suppose if you're calling it something like a Coca-Cola blazer, then it definitely, I think it would go to younger kids, definitely.
What most people don't realise is the polymer that's used to make plastic bottles is exactly the same polymer that's used to make fabrics, polyethylene terephthalate. So old Coke bottles, if you like, can be reformed into useful fabrics.
And how do you go from the kind of rigidity of a Coke bottle, a plastic one, to what we've got here, which is, you know, the blazer you're showing me feels like just like any other form of cloth, soft, not kind of particularly shiny, all the rest of it?
Yeah, what happens is that the bottles that we all put in our bottle banks, most of those end up back in Asia and are resorted into clear plastic bottles. They are chipped and then broken down into the basic polymer ingredients and then repolymerized back into the polymer and then spun out into make a fibre.
And these are the first in the country, first school uniform entirely made of Coke bottles right down to the buttons?
Yeah, this is the first blazer ever to be made where all the ingredients, the fusibles inside the buttons, the zips, the pocket bags, the lining is all made from recycled polyester.
What's been the reaction from schools to this?
They're very, very interested because schools all have sustainability targets and the headmasters and mistresses are all very keen to meet these targets and this would help them achieve those goals.
I gather you were at a conference, weren't you, the other day where this came up?
Yeah, we did a conference in Birmingham, the Specialist Schools and Academies Trust Show, and a lot of interest from head teachers at that conference.
The blazer, you know, when I was a teenager, it was kind of just about on its way out, and then the 60s seemed to kill it altogether, but that's not the case, I gather.
Yeah, what happened is in the late 60s, early 70s, a product that was developed actually for Americans to go jogging in, the sweatshirt, made its way into the uniform market. That's making its way out of the uniform market now, actually, as we go along, because it tends to fade and pill a lot and lose its shape, and it's a leisure wear look. A lot of schools have realised that a more formal look will help with their discipline. So, in particular, inner-city schools that are trying to improve the discipline and education are putting the children back into blazers and ties.
Are they more pricey, these Coca-Cola blazers?
No, we're selling them about £1 more than a conventional blazer. So they'll start at about £25 and go up to about £27 for the larger sizes.
Charlotte Denning here, who works for School Colours, has just been kindly modelling the blazer. What's it like to wear? I mean, is it like any other blazer?
It's very lightweight. Very lightweight indeed. It's kind of, and also it's very soft, so you don't, it's very comfortable to wear. So you don't really, it's not something that, I mean, especially as kind of a school, like you used to wear school uniform. I think kids would find it not uncomfortable, especially if they're wearing it all day and having to wear it, you know, from morning till afternoon.
And would you think, I mean, I've got two, well, they're grown up now, but two sons, when they were boys, they were very hot on all this kind of environmental stuff, you know, and recycling. Is that, do you think that'll have an appeal to school-aged children today?
I think it will. I think it's getting kind of more appealing to kind of the younger generation. Maybe it didn't used to be, but I think it is getting better and better. And I think younger people are realising that and how to recycle, and they're getting taught how to recycle as well. So,
I mean, they might even, could it be cool to wear a Coca-Cola blazer?
I suppose if you're calling it something like a Coca-Cola blazer, then it definitely, I think it would go to younger kids, definitely.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a speech about understanding connections and relationships. First, you'll have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C or D, for questions 7 to 15. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you'll have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates. So everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates. So everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college. But it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path, and that will make all the difference.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about a British tradition involving swans. First, you'll have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 16 to 24 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you'll have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I'm responsible for looking after Her Majesty's swans on the River Thames, where she exercises her royal prerogative right. Swan upping is about conservation. Many, many years ago, of course, the swan was bred for the table, and that was in the 12th century. But of course, now it's, swans are no longer eaten. And as we do this five-day journey from Sunbury to Abingdon each year, each family of swans are taken out from the river. They are weighed, they're measured, and they're checked over. Of course, fishing tackle is one of the serious problems that we have, which actually, in fact, killed quite a few young cygnets. Fishing is a problem to us, but we do talk to fishing clubs throughout the year to try and educate them not to discard their line in hooks, because that is the problem with the young cygnets when it catches around their webs. Also on the five-day journey, we meet many schools, and as today we're going up from Windsor to Marlow, and we will stop at Oakley Court Hotel, where we will meet three or four schools there. We will tell them a little bit about swan upping, the history, the conservation side of it, and how to look after wildlife for the future. And hopefully that this will prevent any vandalism to swans in swan nests for the future. During the swan upping week, we have 6 traditional rowing skiffs, the Vintners Company, the Dyers Company, and of course the Queen's. They're all dressed in their appropriate uniforms to the appropriate company. The Dyers Company and the Vintners Company have had a royal charter to own swans since the 15th century, and they look after swans on the River Thames. We have with us Professor Perrins from the Oxford University of Zoology. Professor Perrins is the Queen's Swan Warden, and he does look after the swans throughout the year and will collect all the data to make sure that the population of swans, not only on the Thames but in the United Kingdom, is maintained to a satisfactory level. As we proceed upriver, we're always going upriver with the boats heading to the stream, and we will the first person to see a family of swans would shout out, "All up!" And then it would be passed right down the group of boats. Then the boats will go in a line, they will go round the young cygnets in the family, the adult birds, the circle will get smaller and smaller, what we call working in the boat. And as we work the boats in closer and closer, then we'll be able to lift the swans out and the young cygnets from the water by hand. We put them in our skiffs. We do tie them up. We tie their legs up and their wings up. We take them to the shore, and then we would actually weigh them and measure them. On the Monday of Swan Upping, we proceed up the river, and when we come to Romney Lock, which is below Windsor Castle, we have a toast to Her Majesty the Queen. This has in fact been done for many, many years.
The Queen!
The swans in the United Kingdom can be claimed by the Queen, but she mainly exercises this prerogative right on the River Thames. It is stated that all swans, unmarked in open waters, belong to the Crown and have done since the 12th century. I'm responsible for looking after Her Majesty's swans on the River Thames, where she exercises her royal prerogative right. Swan upping is about conservation. Many, many years ago, of course, the swan was bred for the table, and that was in the 12th century. But of course, now it's swans are no longer eaten. And as we do this five-day journey from Sunbury to Abingdon each year, each family of swans are taken out from the river. They are weighed, they're measured, and they're checked over. Of course, fishing tackle is one of the serious problems that we have, which actually, in fact, killed quite a few young cygnets. Fishing is a problem to us, but we do talk to fishing clubs throughout the year to try and educate them not to discard their line in hooks, because that is the problem with the young cygnets when it catches around their webs. Also on the five-day journey, we meet many schools, and as today we're going up from Windsor to Marlow, and we will stop at Oakley Court Hotel, where we will meet three or four schools there. We will tell them a little bit about swan upping, the history, the conservation side of it, and how to look after wildlife for the future. And hopefully that this will prevent any vandalism to swans in swan nests for the future. During the Swan Upping Week, we have six traditional rowing skiffs, the Vintners Company, the Dyers Company, and of course the Queen's. They're all dressed in their appropriate uniforms to the appropriate company. The Dyers Company and the Vintners Company have had a royal charter to own swans since the 15th century, and they look after swans on the River Thames. We have with us Professor Perrins from the Oxford University of Zoology. Professor Perrins is the Queen's Swan Warden, and he does look after the swans throughout the year and will collect all the data to make sure that the population of swans, not only on the Thames but in the United Kingdom, is maintained to a satisfactory level. As we proceed upriver, we're always going upriver with the boats heading to the stream, and we will. The first person to see a family of swans will shout out, "All up!" And then it will be passed right down the group of boats. Then the boats will go in a line, they will go round the young cygnets in the family, the adult birds, the circle will get smaller and smaller, what we call working in the boat. And as we work the boats in closer and closer, then we'll be able to lift the swans out and the young cygnets from the water by hand. We put them in our skiffs. We do tie them up, we tie their legs up and their wings up, we take them to the shore, and then we would actually weigh them and measure them. On the Monday of Swan Upping, we proceed up the river, and when we come to Romney Lock, which is below Windsor Castle, we have a toast to Her Majesty the Queen. This has in fact been done for many, many years.
The Queen!
The swans in the United Kingdom can be claimed by the Queen, but she mainly exercises this prerogative right on the River Thames. It is stated that all swans, unmarked in open waters, belong to the Crown and have done since the 12th century.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about a very special photographer. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 25 to 32 with the sentence endings A to J. There is one sentence ending that you should not use. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I don't think there's any place that hits you in the solar plexus the way the first time you come into Yosemite Valley. It's simply overwhelming.
A story from American experience.
Ansel, it changed his life. It completely changed his life. I mean, it was it. Bang. Yosemite became his home place.
As a teenager in 1916, Ansel Adams saw the Yosemite Valley for the first time. I knew my destiny, Adams later wrote, when I first experienced Yosemite.
It's just a very special place to be able to be in and experience.
Michael Fry is a photographer who has lived in Yosemite National Park.
Photographing Yosemite is challenging. It's been photographed so much before. And, of course, photographed by Ansel Adams, who photographed it so well that I don't think his work can really be improved upon. So when you're trying to follow in those kinds of footsteps, it can be a little bit daunting. When you're a nature photographer, you are, to a great degree, at the mercy of the light and the weather. You have no control over those things. So you have to adapt. You have to try to be flexible and put yourself in the right place at the right time rather than having too many preconceived ideas.
Ansel Adams' photographs of Yosemite and the American West changed what Americans thought about their own land.
He drops that horizon, and suddenly you've got these limitless spaces and this incredible feeling of space. And that's when I think he's at his best, when you just can kind of lose yourself in an Ansel Adams sky.
His legacy as a conservationist and as an advocate for wilderness preservation is huge. And, of course, he's said that he never made photographs with a specific intention of using them to promote a conservation cause, but having made these beautiful photographs, he was quite willing to and eager to use those to help to influence public opinion and policy towards preserving wilderness, and did a great deal to help promote conservation, both as a, just as an advocate and a speaker and through his photographs. Nature photography today is so pervasive. It's become almost a commodity, which I think is very different from Ansel's day. In the days of, say, late 50s, early 60s, when the Sierra Club book series came out, they were very influential because I think this was the first time that people had really seen these beautiful nature photographs of these special places that the Sierra Club was trying to preserve. Today, nature photographs are seen in calendars and coffee table books and cards and posters all the time. I actually think that to some extent, because we see so much nature photography these days, its influence might be a little bit diluted.
6 months after Adams' death in 1984, Congress set aside an immense tract of untouched land southeast of Yosemite, the Ansel Adams Wilderness. To learn more and see a gallery of Ansel Adams photographs, visit Ansel Adams online.
I don't think there's any place that hits you in the solar plexus the way the first time you come into Yosemite Valley. It's simply overwhelming.
A story from American experience.
Ansel, it changed his life. It completely changed his life. I mean, it was it. Bang. Yosemite became his home place.
As a teenager in 1916, Ansel Adams saw the Yosemite Valley for the first time. I knew my destiny, Adams later wrote, when I first experienced Yosemite.
It's just a very special place to be able to be in and experience.
Michael Fry is a photographer who has lived in Yosemite National Park.
Photographing Yosemite is challenging. It's been photographed so much before. And, of course, photographed by Ansel Adams, who photographed it so well that I don't think his work can really be improved upon. So when you're trying to follow in those kinds of footsteps, it can be a little bit daunting. When you're a nature photographer, you are, to a great degree, at the mercy of the light and the weather. You have no control over those things. So you have to adapt. You have to try to be flexible and put yourself in the right place at the right time rather than having too many preconceived ideas.
Ansel Adams' photographs of Yosemite and the American West changed what Americans thought about their own land.
He drops that horizon, and suddenly you've got these limitless spaces and this incredible feeling of space. And that's when I think he's at his best, when you just can kind of lose yourself in an Ansel Adams sky.
His legacy as a conservationist and as an advocate for wilderness preservation is huge. And, of course, he's said that he never made photographs with a specific intention of using them to promote a conservation cause, but having made these beautiful photographs, he was quite willing to and eager to use those to help to influence public opinion and policy towards preserving wilderness, and did a great deal to help promote conservation, both as a, just as an advocate and a speaker and through his photographs. Nature photography today is so pervasive. It's become almost a commodity, which I think is very different from Ansel's day. In the days of, say, late 50s, early 60s, when the Sierra Club book series came out, they were very influential because I think this was the first time that people had really seen these beautiful nature photographs of these special places that the Sierra Club was trying to preserve. Today, nature photographs are seen in calendars and coffee table books and cards and posters all the time. I actually think that to some extent, because we see so much nature photography these days, its influence might be a little bit diluted.
6 months after Adams' death in 1984, Congress set aside an immense tract of untouched land southeast of Yosemite, the Ansel Adams Wilderness. To learn more and see a gallery of Ansel Adams photographs, visit Ansel Adams online.
This is the end of the listening test.